When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
Today, Russell, it's very apt, actually, because you did a musical little flourish there. Today, Russell, I am feeling torn. And I'm not referring to Natalie Imbruglia's hit single from the 90s. I'm feeling torn because it's kind of like torn between two very essential emotional states or ways of being. One is visceral, kind of like intuition and like deep, deep digging in within your emotional self and just like trusting that somehow. Mm. And the other is the kind of fight that you have against logic or with logic and kind of like science and fact-based knowledge and kind of intellect. And I think those two worlds, which are obviously common kind of battles that we all have as human beings. But I feel like today's guest so effortlessly kind of combines those two states. Mm. There's a tension in her work, which is actually extraordinary. And the longer I've got to know her work over the past few years, because she had an extraordinary exhibition at the Chisenhale. I think it was amazing. When Polly Staple was still there. And is that right? Yeah, it was when Polly Staple was still there. Mm-hmm. And I just remember seeing that show and I'd never really seen much of her work before. I think I saw a tiny exhibition somewhere else, but it was so extraordinary to see.
It was incredibly immersive, wasn't it? The whole space, like all the walls were covered in newspaper, and yeah, there was works up and there was vitrines, and it was a really immersive experience.
And I remember leaving that exhibition and just thinking a lot about knowledge. And I think, you know, this kind of quest for knowledge and learning is something that's so key to being an artist and to being a fan of art. And I think the guest today is wonderful at kind of teaching all of us about the human psychology and the different emotional states. So I'm very proud. I'm a massive, massive fan of her work. And we've been wanting to do this episode for a while, so I'm thrilled we finally managed to do it. Yeah. I'm really proud to welcome to Talk Art, Mandy Elsa!
Thanks, hi, guys. Thank you. That was so sweet. That was such a nice intro. Thanks, Robert.
Oh, you're
hi, Russell. This is such an honour for me. I'm proper excited.
You're in your studio, we can see behind you at the moment.
Yes.
Whereabouts in the world is that, Mandy?
It's in North Acton, Park Royal, like where I grew up, more or less.
Oh, really?
Local, yeah.
Did you know this space existed when you were growing up there?
No, it hasn't. It's just like a converted warehouse, so they've chopped it up into little units. You might hear some like musicians like recording.
I was just about to say, Park Royal is where I spent the whole of my band years. We used to rehearse in Park Royal before our tour.
Yeah, that's what's happening like around here right now. So probably like the same spot.
Wow, that's so crazy. I'd forgotten about that. That's very cool. What are you working on at the moment? Because you seem to have, your studio seems to be very full of like lots of layers behind you.
Yeah, I mean, it's always full. But at the moment, what am I working on? A show for South Korea coming up in the next few months.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and that's at Lehman Maupin, isn't it?
Yes.
So that's a big solo show you're doing there.
Yeah.
Ooh, is that your first time showing in South Korea?
Yeah, it will be.
Cool.
Well, the work looks incredible behind you. And you're just saying that you don't really ever have an empty studio. How do you balance that? Do you have lots of plates spinning? Like you're saying you're working towards this show now. I would assume that the work would then leave the studio and you'd be starting from scratch. But do you like to have a crossover then between like shows and work?
Yeah, always. Like I can't stand empty space. I'm a self-confessed hoarder.
Yes.
And whenever there's an empty space on a wall, like, I panic. So I have to fit up with something. I have to be immersed by all my stuff. And I think I try to recreate that in a tidier way in shows.
Oh, yes. Right, yeah.
So that must make you incredibly prolific then. You're always driven to kind of fill blank space with your work.
Yeah. I mean, I don't feel like I am, but other people tell me I am. Like, it's always never enough.
For yourself.
For myself, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the hoarding then. So being a self-confessed hoarder, that triggers something in me because I'm a collector and I like to be surrounded by stuff. Some people just don't like to be surrounded by stuff, but you have a lot of stuff that you have, and you have a lot of books around you. And didn't your mum say when you were younger that your bedroom was just disgusting?
Yeah, she still does, because I'm in between my folks and this place. They're around the corner. Really? Yeah.
So where does that come from, this hoarding mentality of having to keep hold of things? And because I guess it's like a compulsive attachment to objects, which I know and Rob has, where you imbue them with some emotional depth so you can't release them. But where do you think that comes from for you?
I think it's just this thing of like moving a lot when you're younger, and you just try and like keep some kind of semblance of stability with things. I remember when I was a kid, I'd travel to Malaysia with my whole stamp book collection in the luggage, which is so stupid because the humidity just does, terrible things to the stamps.
Really? What kind of stamps were you collecting?
Just stuff from all over the world. Wow. Yeah, proper geek.
Oh, no, we're geeks. We love that. So how did the stamps enter your kind of psyche to collect stamps then? It's obviously like you needed to collect something.
Is my dad, he's doing lots of correspondences with people around the world because he had this amateur radio practice. So he'd always have these like letters coming in. And I just thought the stamps were so magical. They had so many layers to them. It's like money, you know, to like stop the kind of counterfeiting that have all those layers. And I always remember like staring at them, looking at them under microscopes and stuff to see all the layers.
Really?
Under microscopes?
Yeah. That was like my favorite first toy. I remember.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So as a hoarder, have you still got them stamps now?
Yeah. For sure.
You do?
Yeah.
You still got the
cool.
They're kept safe at my parents, because they have to be kept, everything needs to be kept in the right spot. So all diaries and stuff like that have to be kept the right person or space. They're all like allocated their special
so
spot.
If you wasn't an artist, you would just have boxes and boxes of stuff, but the biography of your life through the stuff that you've hoarded and collected does end up getting used in your art. So at some point, these stamps might get in and everything else around you. So that must be a release of the hoarding in some
totally.
Way.
I always think that the practice is like, I'm so fortunate to formalize my pathology. Like without it, I won't have that stream of release. So I'm really lucky that I can put it into like play because it has caused a lot of problems for sure.
But saying that this is your personal stuff that's going into the art, and then it's going out in the world and being acquired by collectors and museums and institutions. That must be quite painful then, or is it the process of putting that into the art that releases you from these objects finally?
I'd say it's the latter. It's like a kind of release. It's like a kind it's a kind of therapy. I remember someone saying like, oh, like, you don't have any references, because my identity and memory is quite fragmented. So our family like migrated from like Sharjah when I was 5, just like without any extended family. So that family system.
Where is that? Sorry, Mandy.
In Sharjah, it's really close to Dubai, so it's in the GCC.
Right. Okay.
And so I guess it's my way of like having a history for myself. Being so disconnected to my own. Yeah.
It's really interesting because I was thinking a lot about the work you make. And for me, there's this kind of like dark side to it, very much about like death and the body and kind of like the
decay,
the failing of the body and the kind of destruction of it almost. But running through it, there is this sense of continuity. And there's just like, it's not something you can actually logically explain. But for me, I have a feeling whenever I look at your work, even if I see, like we were recently at Tadeusz Ropak and we interviewed Julia and Dame Julia, and she had one of your works in her office that day. And even just seeing that single work, it feels like there's this continuous thread running through the work. And it's a kind of like energy force or like a bloodstream or something quite, you know, visceral, like the word I used earlier. And it's fascinating to hear you talk about this idea of like, it's always been with you. It's like a kind of continuous thread through your life, and your work's been drawn out of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really nice way of putting it. I guess it's, again, coming from this anxiety that I don't have a history or identity, but I do have a body that's anxious. And I guess growing up in a family with someone with a chronic illness, that colours the whole language of things. My mum was a midwife, so my dad had this chronic kidney condition. So in a way, their broken English was always around this idea of like the body and what to do with it. And I guess that syntax just kind of seeped into our family. So it was always like, you know, try not to bring infection home and try, because, you know, my dad's immunocompromised. And my mum coming back from work, she'd talk about her clients and things like that. And being a very anxious child, I'd have like stuff happening in my body and I'd wonder about it, you know? So I always think like not having references, we all do have a body that could get ill, you know, or a body that can do things. So that's the one thing, if everything was taken away, we do have, you know, this vulnerability. And I'm quite literal, so I literally like see it as, you know, anatomy, essentially.
That's right. Well, people coming to your work now and hearing this conversation will see the figure in your abstracted works present, and especially the flesh. And what Rob was saying, it feels very forensic at times. And hearing, you know, your childhood and having this experience as your mum as a midwife and being aware of an illness with your father, that has, you can see your work has so heavily influenced the materiality of the surfaces and everything that you work with.
Yeah, I think the blank canvas is just the worst kind of like uninspiring surface. So I kind of try and create a wound in the kind of ground that I can work around and modify and stitch together. That way I feel like I'm making something, like I'm making this kind of corpse, and I'm fixing stuff together to make these fragments, which can be like artifacts, like have a body, like to give it some integrity, to give it life. Like it's almost like, again, it's very therapeutic. Like I'm birthing these things that can't exist by themselves because they don't have enough context. I always struggled with that. Like I wasn't enough of a thing to put myself forward. So I'd have to suture together like a coherent body of little things.
I like the fact that you use the word suture as well, because that is like a medical term for post-injury or you know, recovery, and that is a term that you've sort of given yourself for the stitching together of the materiality in your practice.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, this language that you've created, like to describe your work, but also the language of your work, is so important to understanding what it is you're putting out in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have that art language fully embedded, even though I went to art school. It just never stuck. I can't remember artists' names, even the ones I like, you know. But so it's just this thing that's just a constant, at least that keeps me together. So that's why I guess like therapeutic language is more apt when I'm discussing my work, or medical as well.
Is it more familiar as well to you, I guess, because it's like something that you've kind of grown up around in a way?
Yeah. That way I feel like I'm not like lying with verbose kind of art terms.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think your generation, our generation, in a way, with the art education system, especially in like the UK, for example, and America, everyone's had to kind of intellectualize their work before they've even made it or even begun their career. And I always find it quite strange when you do kind of thesis visits or whatever, tutor visits, I've done them a few times, the way that they've hardly made any work, but they can stand up and talk to you all about
they've
what it
the
is
vocabulary,
they're doing.
Haven't they?
And sometimes it feels so separated. But what I like about what you, when you speak about it, like I heard journalists try and describe your work as collage and you were just like, no, like,
no way.
You know, which I love that actual, the clarity and the confidence you have to, you know, it's good, I think, to hold on to that authentic self.
Yeah, I was giving a few tutorials at Goldsmiths. It's like BA mainly. And I'm just jealous how, like, they're at that stage where they don't have to think too much about that language. And I think the younger generation are less embedded in that kind of dense theory, you know. Even though I do read theory, but they're just quite disparate and come up and go away as soon as they, yeah.
How often are you in the studio then? So what brings you to the studio every day? What is your driving force that takes you there and sees you through the day?
It's quite unhealthy because this immersion that you see spatially I have, like, with my life. So this thing I'm sitting on is like a fold-out bed. So I like sleep here, even though I'm not meant to. I call it like a shift. So technically it's like labor kind of sleeping. I'm allowed to sleep in the studio. So I come every day. I basically live here. And I start my shift around like 9 at night all the way to like 6 in the morning. Wake up. Yeah. Go to my folks. Try and run and do something with my body. Yeah. And then, yeah. So this idea of immersion, being immersed in the space and the work to the point that I can't really see because I do drink. I like this. I always think of this idea of immersion and taking away that inner critic. You know, so if I'm immersed in the material, I can see color better. I can see texture better. I can make connections in this way that's more like... sensuous, let's say.
So you were saying,
it sounds very romantic, but it's true.
No, I love that. But you were saying about being an anxious child and anxiety. That feels like a material that you are able to channel that if you didn't have art might be sparking somewhere else, but you're able to channel that into your practice.
Yeah, totally. I think this last year I had what I can call a proper full-on nervous breakdown.
Oh,
and
did.
But so after it, I kind of realized how important the practice was. Before, I thought I was lucky. Before, I'd see myself as lucky. Oh, how lucky I am to have this kind of outlet. So many other artists are struggling to have what I have. But I thought, like, whoa, like, without this, there would be, like, literally this shell, this nervous wreck, you know. And so I have a newfound kind of... gratitude for like this channel. Yeah.
And is it significant, the idea that you go in so late? So is the nighttime a kind of stream of consciousness? Does it, because the rest of the world's probably quieter and they're all asleep.
Yeah.
Is there some element of that in freeing
totally.
You up?
Totally.
I love that.
The night is mine. Like, I feel like it's all mine. Whereas the day, as soon as I could hear like the cars and the trucks like waking up, it's just like, oh no, it's over. But now I have these like grime artists on top of me, like we're doing like battles with our bass, so I don't feel like it's mine anymore the night. But it's also quite nice because they kind of like this, like our shifts are quite similar, so it's nice to know that there's other kind of practices like that, nocturnal ones.
You can work with other sounds happening around you.
I've learned to.
You've had
to. Yeah, but normally I like to be completely alone, completely immersed.
What I love about your work, Mandy, is that it is on the surface very abstracted and there's lots of elements in there, but it to me feels like the portrait of a figure. It feels like a human being that we're seeing that's incredibly abstracted, and that the choices of the tones of the material used, like for the Financial Times, for example, you source a lot of newspapers, but you love that newspaper because of the fleshy colour, because of the pink pages. Is that right to say that it's an abstracted kind of figuration that your practice is about?
Totally. I think, like, I'm very, again, very, very literal, and it's just because of the sheer amount of detail and layering that abstraction happens. So the abstraction happens like not from a subtraction, but from like a density of like too muchness. So eventually kind of you can't see it anymore, but it's always a buildup of like flesh. Even the grids, like when I stretch them, I imagine them as like a thickness of flesh, the grids. So it's like three pieces of meat to me. Like I see the world like that. Whenever I enter a space, I can see the thickness of paint laid up on the wall. Like, I'm always very aware of texture and material in that kind of very literal way. And the figure is always a reference point because there is no kind of imagined images. I'm always referring to something. Even my color palette, I don't have a sense of color in that, in the way that some painters do. So I'm always referring to like skin diseases or bruising, which is a nice layering of different layers of blood in the tissue. So I'm always looking at source material as well.
Well, let's talk about the actual layering of the works then, like the process. You said you started off with a ground and you actually built in like a scar that then you could use as a feature and build up from. How are your works layered? How do you work it? How is your practice?
With the paintings, it's different to the objects, but I guess it's the same methodology, that I just collect lots of shit and mm-hmm. lay everything out and let the periphery take over. And so I'd lay out all these pieces of linen, say, and all the bits and pieces and rags that would be around would kind of make their way into the ground. And I'd kind of like use my hands to kind of smooth on the paint like a lotion. I'm thinking of like Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah.
And he rubs the lotion onto the back.
I love that film. Yeah. Oh my God. I just watched it again during the first lockdown.
Oh my God, it's brilliant.
It's extraordinary. And it's still so good now. That's just a classic film.
Yeah.
God, that's interesting thinking about that film and your work.
Yeah.
Well, it's so piercing the skin on, isn't it? It's like Buffalo Bill is making a whole new skin. Those references must be so important to you, like movies that show that sort of them characterization.
Oh, totally, totally. Like, I would say that's influenced me a lot more than looking at artists. So, like,
really?
Yeah, Cronenberg, David Lynch, like all those early Cronenbergs, like, totally. Even the palette, there's like this kind of like muddiness to them. And then the flesh, the fly was like totally like pivotal.
Yeah.
Really? When did you first see that?
Like, when I was like 7 or something.
Really?
Too young.
Yeah,
too
I used to stay up late. I'm an insomniac, so I'd stay up late, and I remember like all the stuff that would come on like Channel 4 back then.
Yeah.
That's interesting, because it's like there's like an ominous threat or something in some of those shows, though, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's like a kind of terror in a way. And I've heard you describe it before, like that you want your work to kind of encompass and embody everything in the world, from like politics to sexuality to the kind of terror of excess, which I love that phrase, like terror in excess. It's like, it's just, it's a fascinating sort of state of being. So, God, that's intense.
I know. I tried to, in the shows, try to create some kind of like balance or kind of zen with the feng shui and the spacing. That's where it comes in. But yeah, it's a way to, I guess the practice is the way to manage my too muchness, mm-hmm. like filtering all this information. When I had this breakdown thing, it's really strange what happened to me, because I didn't know it was happening. It happened after a long period of depression. And then weirdly enough, words started becoming more loaded with meaning. So anything I'd see, that I'd intake through my eyes, could end up becoming a really bad chain of thought. So like even looking at newspaper and seeing certain headlines would really affect me. So I had to turn them like on their back. So there's this thing where I think like artists have it in general, they have the tangential thinking where things can just go off and not on their own kind
spiral.
Of
spiral.
Spiral. Yeah, so I was spiraling with all the things around me. So I tried to stay alone. I tried not to see too much, but still the things in even my own work started to scare me. So I just stopped making work completely and thought, okay, I need to just start moving my body or do something. And that's when I ended up doing some like performance piece that I can't even like comprehend fully yet. I need more time to process that.
This was at Frieze, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Exhibition space. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I watched that today. I thought it was really powerful. The way you move is.
That was the feeling that I had at that, with that kind of breakdown.
It was quite jagged. And
I couldn't.
Sharp.
Yeah, I couldn't.
Trying to shake stuff off. But yeah. It was kind of taking over you. And
yeah.
You were taking bits of your like clothing off and giving it to someone else, trying to get rid of like the white or something, and that it was still weak.
Oh, you're bringing it all back, Russell.
I'm sorry. Well, I just think, well, that isn't that what art is meant to do?
Yeah.
Isn't that you're channeling, like, or your practice, your work is channeling something in you?
Yes.
This performance was exercising some energy, some like spiky spirit that you had. I think that's really so brilliant that you're able to talk about this, but also you're able to use art to exorcise demons.
Yeah, and in that way, I kind of like, I'm so, again, grateful. I see how important it is now. Because that energy, that was like a stimming that I had, you know, and I had to kind of like formalize it some, you know, in some way. And I remember just looking in the mirror and I could like see my own face, you know, and I was thinking, how can I use that mirror to kind of create, a plan of like two people moving in space. Mm. And then I just mapped it out and used an old kind of like skin, what I call a skin, which is the blue works, as the kind of surface for the performance to happen. There was this lady that was outside the studio, caravan lady, and she was my doppelganger that I met. And she was like the same height as me. She was an artist, same shoe size, and it became very intense quite quickly. I let her in the studio. So it got, and I was, you know, installing the Ropak show at the time. So I was going from, you know, this place where this person, you know, extremely vulnerable, something really terrible had happened to her, in the worst conditions and like in that squat system around Tottenham. And then going into like Mayfair with like heels, like tinkering on the marble floor. And it was such a kind of bizarre kind of reality for me to like go in between these two spaces. So I had to think about how I could express what was happening, because there was such an absurdity that I couldn't process at the time. At one point, I couldn't get rid of her. So it's this thing of like having empathy for this person that had gone through something, and then it being
knowing
a threat.
Your boundaries.
Yeah, exactly. I'm really terrible. I'm like one of those artists that is like too much information. I have very like, you know, porous boundaries, and yeah.
That's like skin again.
Yeah, exactly. The skin is very, very thin.
I mean, we've all been there. I've struggled with boundaries for a long time because it's like really hard, especially when you're quite an empathic person.
Yeah.
And you want to like love and support and help other people, particularly through trauma.
Totally.
And then sometimes it can just go past that, can't it? And it's
totally.
Too much and it starts to take away from yourself.
Yeah. And it feels quite like violent to instate boundaries, even though you need them. And I guess that's what the practice is trying to do. Like, if I create a frame, that means I have to stop the work, or the table stops the kind of hoarding section. So it's like, it's a way to kind of like just forcefully put a boundary in place.
Can we talk about the tables? Because that was something that I think, did you introduce that during the Chisenhale era, like in that show?
The vitrines.
Can you speak a bit about that side of the work?
I've always been collecting or hoarding stuff. So it's just essentially that. And it's a way to kind of look at these objects and give them their space instead of them being this base material. So I guess it's this forensic kind of gaze where you can like give space to examine in detail what these things are. And they're often like really personal things with really kind of like ephemeral things or ubiquitous things. And I like this idea of it being like going from the personal to the universal, to the local, and going through those different scales and them having all like this kind of connectivity that I can't necessarily process in language, but you can through material and texture.
Right. And actually, that's quite interesting, because the idea of language in your work is obviously such a kind of obvious literal one, in the sense that there's words everywhere and that you can even, as a visitor, like visit and start reading loads of newspaper articles. And then I've heard you describe it then when you look at the paintings, you read them in a different way. You know, it's like, but what I really liked was this idea that you like words for their shape, not necessarily for their meaning. And for someone who's obviously very deeply empathic, even with words, and they can help you spiral off into another place. Can you speak a bit about that? And also your father's like calligraphy and that whole kind of element of the movement of words and the shape of words.
I wish I had my diary from last year, because then I could talk about it more. My words went completely off on their own thing. I think there's
like
a few
journal.
My journal. I think there's a few like posts on Instagram that I'm so embarrassed about. That was during that time. And it's the way that words kind of just go off on their own tangent. More than particular words, the way that words just go off on their own thing with just their phonetics, just the fluidity of like of rhyme or homophone. So, and I guess that's this thing of like it being taken away from like context, it being taken away from fact and more into the realm of like plasticity and paint. And mm-hmm. I guess that's how I read my dad's writing, and that's how he treats his language too, when it's more about like shape and gesture and form, more to do with the hand. So it takes it back to this base kind of place. And when I was a carer, I worked with autistic nonverbal young people, and the kind of drawings they would do would be in time with like music or rhythm. So it's more a rhythmic kind of mark making. So almost like meaning dissolves from language, mm-hmm. More than liking particular words, although I do like some.
Interesting.
Didn't your dad make do calligraphy for a sultan?
For the Sheikh of Sharjah.
And he does it every day now. He practices calligraphy every day. And these things he just does on, you said, on tabloid newspapers and then throws them away. But you, as a self-confessed hoarder, you would then collect these every day and then use them in your work.
Yeah. So, like, I like that he didn't give them meaning. So I like that he treated the practice was more primary. So it was more about like him doing it, just him getting up to do it rather than the finished product. And like the texture of like newspaper was a nice kind of surface for his stylus. He'd make his own kind of styluses. So I think when he found out I was taking them, it did change his relationship to the practice a bit. So he became more aware. And
self-aware,
I was like,
yeah,
and I liked all the ones that, you know, or a bit more fucked up or a bit more loose, you know. I won't get them anymore because he knows that he wants to give like a more kind of proportion.
Well, he knows they're going to end up at a gallery wall. You prefer them when they were unguarded.
Yes.
But now he's like, aware that he's being sort of observed.
Yeah, exactly. It changes everything.
Yeah. So what's the quality of the grid? Because that for me, that feels the most successful thing about your work and the most drawn to and the most unique to you is this really tight modernist sort of grid pattern that goes through the whole like practice of yours. I know your language is really recognizable to you, but the metaphor for the grid feels like it's something really important, but also how the grid sits within your work. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I can go off on so many different tangents.
Love it.
In one sense, it's about a memory, a very particular memory. In another sense, it's like this using this motif of modernism as a cover, like almost like you use that as a hook to exist because it's just such a robust motif to use. On the other hand, it's just like just a very dumb action of like just doing lines and passing time, and also like trying to create this automatic kind of motion. So should I go into this memory, or is this going to ruin the abstraction? I always think I should write a text about this, but let's see if it works. When I was a kid, I still feel like I'm a kid that refuses to like grow up. I think that's all artists are that in a
that's
sense.
All of us as well.
Yeah.
That's a talk art vibe.
Definitely a good thing. So I have emetophobia. This is key to like my whole how I experience the world. So I haven't thrown up since I was like 5 years old. And every emetophobe, someone who's like fearful of vomit, will always say like with so much pride how many years they haven't thrown up for. I haven't thrown up since I was five. I'm so scared of it. And I think it came from this coming to London and like us like living in like close quarters, and my mum have like mum having these really long shifts on the NHS and coming back really knackered. These shifts were crazy, and just having that one chance to eat, and like she had like an eating disorder, so like us all being in the same room, we'd be like. My brother and sister would sleep, and I'm an insomniac. I find it really hard to sleep. We'd just hear these noises, and I thought, like, you know, this is my mum suffering, essentially. And I remember going to school one day and I hated going swimming. I hated all kinds of sports. I make up all kinds of excuses to get out of them. The one time I decided to go, I'm really scared. Like, again, it's this very anxious body of, like, something happening when you're in this open space. It's kind of like a form of agoraphobia, I'd say. Mm. I finally go, and a kid is sick in the, like, other end of the pool. And the sick is coming towards me in this kind of, like, if you imagine, like, a formal kind of picture kind of realm, it's, like, fleshy-coloured, and it's coming towards me, like, this kind of moving, shapeless entity. And then the lifeguard comes with this cadmium pink, cadmium red plastic net, like, you know, a mesh net, and attempts to scoop this up, the stuff, and it's just dropping through the net. And I remember it in colors. I remember it very visually, like the turquoise, you know, like how swimming pools are that turquoise color, the flesh, which is the sick, and the net. So I'm trying to always put these three things together where they hold, but they're never holding. And they're always like escaping. And I kind of see that as like a very horrible metaphor for this body in pieces in a way. But when I'm creating these grids and I get to a point where I'm happy, it transcends its horror. It goes to a place where it's holding at the right frequency. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to let it go. I can see it in different things sometimes, like in stains, or I can see it in like, natural matter.
The net is also, I mean, that's an incredible story, very visceral. I didn't have the same experience, but when I was younger, I remember swimming at the Dolphin Centre in Romford in Essex, and there was a floating poo. that was floating around, and it was I nearly ate it. And I remember there was a wave machine, and everyone was screaming,
Lord.
And I couldn't get hands on. And there was I was screaming, and there was a floater that was just sort of like a little Malteser just bobbing past my head. Oh. That stayed with me, and I must have been about, you know, 6 or 7. But
wow, it's always a good place when we're talking about shit. It's everything. Yes. It literally is everything.
Yeah, well, that's very, you know, that's the human body. That's what you're, them sort of like sources for you. You're not scared of. These are things that you feel like make up what it is to be human.
Totally. It's just another memory from my mother. She said that when she was growing up, she grew up in a village where it's very poor. But she remembered that this kid would just like be just eating its own shit. And she was like, that was just completely normal. And she said she attributes her really good immunity to the fact that she grew up in a jungle environment where she was touching and putting everything in her mouth. And she, her immunity obviously grew these defenses.
Wow.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
I love these stories of family in your work. I think it's such a wonderful thing, the kind of strong bond you all have.
It's autobiographical.
And the honesty of it all. Yeah. And I loved that story about your mum and the rubber tree plantation, and then this concept, that kind of memory of a visual memory, but passed on from her to you.
Mm. But I also think it's super important that I don't necessarily have to tell them. Like, it's just nice. It's a nice connect when I do.
Right, okay.
But it's also important that the work doesn't need that.
Well, it feels like your work is autobiographical to a level. You layer it at the bottom with this very personal, very visceral, and then you level up from there. You go up from there, and then the surfaces become more universal. So yeah. Like you were saying earlier, it starts at the personal, and that's where you are on the base, and you're in there, you're embedded, you're at the bottom, and then from there you're taking it out so other people can, you know, project onto it and recognise themselves in it.
I mean, it works on multiple levels, like in that it's an exercising of like my immediate experience, my mother's testimony, because she always says that, oh, she's like, you know, she's had such a hard life, and I think when she retired, she'd been working so hard, she didn't, like many parents, they didn't know what to do with themselves in retirement, and she's like, she was a child laborer in this jungle rubber tapping, and so working at that intensity till you're like in your late 50s, and then suddenly you stop and all you have is like, so now we have a crazy garden, it looks like a jungle because she needs to put the energy somewhere. So in a way it's like taking on the responsibility of like that burden from both my folks and processing it and putting it into, make it okay for me as well.
It's inherited, isn't it?
Something, yeah, we can't get away from our stuff really, can we?
No, it's all like you inherited, we all inherit our generations or the generations above trauma in some ways. And it feels like your work, you've inherited what your parents have been through, even though you haven't personally experienced it, but that still lives through you, and now that is part of your work.
Yeah, and that's a specific kind of experience to absolutely have that weight but not have gone through it.
But there is an openness to your work, though, which is completely the opposite of all this stuff we've been talking about. Even the titles of your work, like if you think of like the title Net Grid, it's quite like open, isn't it? It's not autobiographical. It hasn't got like a kind of sentence about a street you grew up on or your mum's name or anything like personal like that. And even like the peace paintings or, I don't know, can you speak a bit about that side of the work and how you title and use words actually to describe the object or name the object?
I think access is really important, not unlike what you guys are doing. So that everyone can enter at any level. That's super important. So it has that space where people can relate, because that the body is like a universal thing, right? So you can enter from like, you know, formalist perspective or like just object perspective, material perspective. So I guess I'm thinking a net on one hand is a thing, and a grid can be a number of things, and they can come together and you can experience them in multiple ways.
Well, the grid and the net metaphorically and literally have like, is catching information and containing it. Like you were saying, the table stops, you know, the hoarding continuing, and the net contains, keeps it all together, keeps it safe, keeps this what could be sprawling information, sprawling, like coming in and out, it keeps it contained.
Mm. And then the grid, by contrast, is like can be a virtual schema, you know, in like coding space in on the computer, or like this non-material kind of way to arrange space, essentially.
Mm. And you only work in one size, and then you have studies, because the one we saw at Tadeusz Ropak was a smaller work. I think it was like a meter by a meter, I want to say. I might be wrong about that. But you normally work in sizes of 225 by 235 centimeters.
Yeah.
And then these other works are seen as studies for the bigger works. Why have you set that rule for yourself when it comes to these pieces?
I'm quite rigid in like the rules I give myself. Otherwise, again, you just have this spiraling. So the studies have this kind of rule where it's like no more than 3 nights, like to finish. The net grids, the big ones, they can take any amount of time to like get layered to the right, you know, moment. So the thing with the studies is sometimes like I'm not happy with them, but I have to let them go. Like it's, so they have this kind of different dynamic. They have a speed to them. Like sometimes the paint's not dry. They're kind of like wet on wet often. And because I limit myself with time, I could see the kind of different dynamics with my hand, and the material does something else. So it's a way to kind of examine the differences of time, I guess.
Mm. You know, I was thinking back to earlier on when you mentioned about the microscope. And when I was thinking about the introduction today, I was thinking about you almost as being this kind of interrogator, like a detective with a torch, somehow like above all of that intense visceral emotion and actually quite analytical and quite scientific. So it fascinates
forensic,
me that...
Forensic science, yeah.
But like this idea that you're sort of like shining a torch within the soul or something, because that's something that I love, obviously, is like soul.
Yeah.
That's what hates me talking about.
I love it. Let's talk about the soul in Eckhart Tolle, because I was listening to him, the pain body, how like you're meant to be the observer that is looking at the pain body or your suffering self, and that distance is essentially meditation, and it gives you distance from like the immediacy, I mean, of the past kind of pains, and you're focused on this kind of transcendental distance. But I'm more like a kiddie scientist more than anything. It's not like really like forensic
pop,
examination.
Pop scientist.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. So it's just, again, I think all practices are a way to create distance with many with yourself and the trauma through like aesthetics or action. So yeah, there is this creating of distance, but I guess the connections only happen like way later. When I look back on the work or, yeah, revisit it. But as I'm kind of assembling, it's quite an intuitive process of just, like, putting, like, colour and form together and words and sentences. They have their own kind of bizarre logic.
Mm. So maybe the exhibition making is where it becomes more scientific in a way.
Yeah.
Because that's when you get the distance. And
yes.
You were talking about the way you construct the space.
Yeah. And that's why it's super important, like, who I'm working with, because often, like, very much informed by, you know, the curators or the conversations I'm having around that time.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've read a quote where you said, you're always trying to stop yourself. That's where a curator comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, because I guess it's this thing where I don't have an idea. I never have any ideas. It's just a filling up of space. That's what I do. So if I was left to my own devices, if you notice, there is a thread to all the kind of installations where there is like a tendency towards like filling.
Yeah.
So I always
every
surface. I don't like empty space. So I always like liken the process to how gases would move in a room. Eventually, they would just fill out the space in an even way. There's no kind of like specific corner they would choose the particles of gas.
It makes me think of the room that you had in the show recently at Tadeusz Ropak, and it was a group show that you shared with Rachel Jones and Alvaro Barrington, and you have a room, and it was a whole room. You walk in and you feel slightly, you have to put shoes on. I remember them. You have to put little slippers on because you're walking across the surface and it's underfoot. But there is, now you saying that, there wasn't a door in that room, and part of me feels like I want to give you a door suddenly because I want it. I want it because them gases are going to get out of the door because you can see it and it draws you in. But you kind of want that feeling of containment, like as if
I think it's that again. It's like very it could be like very childlike in that I want to be contained, but at the same time, I remember I was going through that thing at the time, and air was like I could feel things more physically. So I felt suffocated when I was in there when the latex was. Not when it was raw, but when it had dried, I thought it was suffocating. And me and Julia were talking about like the feng shui in the room and how we had to leave the window open. So I was like obsessed with keeping this window open. Whenever I came into the room and the window wasn't open, I'd freak out because there had to be like a stream of energy coming in and out because it was so full. So I guess I'm like always like mediating this fullness or too muchness and moderating what's good.
Well, it's an instinctive energy then that runs through your practice, and it's installation feels like it's incredibly important to you. So what is it like working with a gallery? What are the pressures of that, or and what are the bonuses and the pros and cons of that?
I mean, the person that's my liaise is super important because I'm super like emo, so those kind of very personal relationships. And like I always said, like ideally I would have like a shoot in the studio and I just throw the work through the chute and not have to interact with anyone. You know, I'm like one of those, you know, hermit people.
Like an American trash chute kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, exactly.
Down the building.
Yes, yeah. I'd love that.
And have an art shipper at the end.
Yes.
Take it all away.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. So in a way it works because my constant making, there's always somewhere for it to go. And I'm always like, I'm not fast, but it's constant. There's a constant stream of stuff, so it's good to have like somewhere for it to go. The pressures are like when the work is named, and I guess I'm always thinking about spaces. I'm always thinking about conversations. I'm always thinking about how these little members of the family can sit in a space, and to ask for a part is like a bit painful. Like we want two net grids or whatever. But that's the same for any artist, I'm sure.
Yeah, like the kind of the battle and the compromise between the commerce and the...
Yeah, and I have to find ways to make it still magical for me to make work and not be thinking about that.
But it sounds great that you're doing this duo show with Lee Bull. Can you speak a bit about that show? And is that in New York at Lehman Maupin?
Yeah.
That sounds great. I love Lee Bull's work.
Me too. I mean, I'm super excited to have this show with her. And why it was cool is that she's working on this really major show in South Korea, one of the major museums. I'm terrible. And it's looking at her older work, where she's her more performance-based work with the female body and you know, her archetypal early stuff. So she didn't have time to kind of really engage with the making of the show. And I love the idea that this show could come together just like this kind of corpse of body parts, and it just come together because of the connections they already have inherently. So I know that she had a couple of works and I had to respond to them with the space we had. And I was like, had my fingers crossed with the hang. And it just worked. The palettes worked. The forms and the kind of conversations about this, these, these biomorphic shapes resonated with the kind of latex. It was just very natural how it just kind of came together.
Amazing. And is it important for you, kind of like intergenerational conversations? Because Liebel isn't like ancient, but she's like late 50s. I think she was born in like 64. So is that a nice thing for you to like have this show with a, you know, an artist from the next generation up?
Yeah, like it's reassuring that stuff can talk to each other in a way that it isn't forced and it's just always there. There's this constant connecting over time.
Yes.
Without like a forced contextualizing. Yeah, of course, it's super important for me to be having those dialogues.
I was thinking a lot about the Max Mara Prize that you were part of a number of years ago. And if you think of like Helen Kamek, a previous Talk Art guest, and I adore her work and I think she's an amazing human being as well.
Yeah,
and I saw that you're both going to be in the British Art Show next year,
yeah.
Which is super exciting. The British Art Show 9, I think, isn't it? It's the 9th edition of it. But how does that feel to be, you know, invited to be part of such a significant touring exhibition?
Amazing.
As a British artist.
Yeah, it's strange.
It's like a, you know, it's quite a big deal, isn't it, here?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm super, super honoured to be having dialogues with all these people I admire. And, but you know what? To be honest, I don't really think about these things until, like, the deadline hits. I feel really, really fortunate that the work is resonating. But, yes.
It's vibrating.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, I think one of the kind of press releases had this thing, or, like, tendencies in contemporary art practices. And it's nice to know that there's, like, these new tendencies and that's being picked up.
Yes, definitely.
What was it like to have your first solo at the Chisenhow, which is one of our most important and respected and wonderful institutions that we have, in 2019 in your show Cite Your Sources, which again is something I'd like to talk about the title of that show, because that was a quote from one of your tutors. But what that was, to go from recently graduating to then having a solo at the Chisenhow, what did that feel like? And was there any sort of like anger from your fellow students, fellow your peers that were like, what the fuck?
You like to get in there. actually, I wasn't newly graduated. It'd been quite a while. I'd given up. So it's extra special for me because I'd not expected any of it. So when I graduated, I thought there's no way I can do this in a sustainable way. That's when I started doing social work and care work. So like my practice is like only been seen quite recently. If you look at all the shows, it's like 2017, 2019 onward, really. So I'm not really a young artist that just came out, even though it seems that way. So to start out on that footing was incredible, to work with Polly and Ellie and the team and just have them like really understand the work quite intimately and rigorously. It really set the bar. And yeah, it feels really good. In terms of like what other my peers think, I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't really socialize. I don't have like an extended artistic community, actually. Artist community. There's a few people I'm really close to, but yeah, it's all in this little bedroom space that exists.
I love the idea of it being a bedroom, because cushioning, I feel like your whole creative world is like this kind of thing to protect you, but also some sense of healing. Because I know you've mentioned a lot in the past, even just as like a metaphor, but like bruising and bruises, like within colour. I loved the description of all of that. And then it got me thinking about bruises and then the cushioning and the kind of healing and the recovery. And I don't know, it's like, it's super intense, all that stuff. I just really connect to it.
Yeah, I like that way of thinking, and in that sense, like, I don't know what it would mean to, like, I really admire artists that work in a socially engaged way, and for me, it's I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. It's more personal. So like my social engagement is like one on one, probably like mentoring or like a relationship with like a musician working on another piece, or you know, it's super, everything's super emo. Yeah.
I love that. But you know what though, the work and the exhibitions is your way of collaborating and is your way of connecting to a much, much wider audience and an international audience. So in a way that is, I think sometimes having that kind of rigid focus on, you know, yourself in a sense, and making yourself the best version of you.
That's what the guilt comes from there.
Right, yeah. But it's like a generous thing though in the end. The actual act of that self-focus can end up being this incredible generous act. So we've definitely grateful for it.
Yeah. But just go back to the Chisenhale show. So you had the title Cite Your Sources.
Oh, yeah.
And that was a quote from something your tutor said to you. Why did you choose that title and why did that stay with you?
I just gave a talk at Kingston and Dan, the guy that Kidner that organised it, saying it's an injunction that every tutor gives their student in contextual studies. So it's an injunction for every writer. So it's like an overarching law. So I like to think about this in terms of like, it's like asking you to make a proof of yourself, like make yourself legitimate. So, and that is such a pressure. And that if your sources are like precarious, if your history, your references, your past, your identity is you know, fragmented, how do you even begin? You know, like if you don't have your spiel ready, if you don't know what it is, if you don't, you know, how does one go about putting together a coherent body and make themselves legitimate in now? So that is like my kind of reaction to this thing to appear, to make myself legitimate.
I think there's something really special about artists that can make without the idea there at the beginning in a way. So if you can find the ideas through the making, so you can just trust yourself enough just to make the work, get involved in it, and then afterwards all the thinking and the ideas will come out of it.
Yeah, all together. Yeah. Like this Lee Bull show, which is nice. And I always think that with Cite Your Sources is that it will just, you know, fall into place. Because you can never really do it. It's an impossibility. You can never really pin it to one thing. You can never really say, whatever you're saying, it's going to escape that explanation, what you're doing.
It's funny, when I first saw your work, I was thinking loads about Agnes Martin. And that was actually the first thing I ever thought. And it's funny that when you do see work, it's all subjective to your own art history knowledge or your own things that you love. Because I love Agnes Martin, therefore I was very quick to love your work. But the more I looked at it, I was like, it's actually quite different, because I always think your grids, like the red painted
grid. I think Rosemary Trockle.
Rosemary Trockle's a good one too. Yeah. Oh my God, I love Rosemary Trockle. I love Rosemary Trockle. Yes. But you know, I always think of it almost like handwriting. So like when you're doing these freehand kind of grids, because even though they are a grid, they're actually all wavy and they're kind of
wobbly.
Like writing without words though.
Yeah. Like calligraphy in some ways. Yeah. It's like,
Oh, I never thought of it like that. That's nice.
But
I always am quite careful to say those big names I do like, because the moment I do, it's like, oh, it's like that. That's what you're doing, you know? And it's like, it's a million things. It's more Cronenberg for me. But if you do say Agnes Martin, Ava Hess is like, oh, of course. But you know, Ava Hess,
you'll take those, yeah.
Yeah.
I know what you mean. It's almost like it shuts you down. It limits you.
Yeah,
when actually you're so much more than just one thing, you know?
Well, it's
the Cronenberg thing's very cool. I love that filmic element to it.
Yeah. I guess like we're pulling from so many different sources. I like what Alvaro Barrington says about like stealing, like artists stealing.
I steal from
I don't think I steal per se. I just think that they're just it's just around. And if you work with latex people and you're a woman, Ava Hess is a bit lazy.
I think of a lot. I see Paul Tech a lot.
Actually, he's one of my favorites that I would say. I actually would say, like, yeah, I really, really loved his work. I love that he just did bodies of work and he moved on, because he just wanted to, it felt like he's a true artist doing stuff for himself.
Yeah.
One of his best works, I think, is this questionnaire he gave to, like, students. And it's basically inquiring about the nature of desire, like what do you do before a date and things like that. And I just thought this kind of layout of this questionnaire was just so beautiful. I don't know if it's a work though. I think it's just part of his teachings.
But that makes me think of a work that I've actually come to because of you, which was by Richard Serra, which is Verbalist, which you cite as one that is quite influential to your practice from 63 to 68. And it's all different descriptions for what you can do to paper. And it feels very visceral. And I love that. And I don't know if you have that to hand, but would you consider reading a section of that out? Because it's so good.
Oh, I need to open up my Google.
It's so good.
Should I do this? Let's see.
Well, only if you feel comfortable, don't
Let's
you?
Let's do it. Sarah.
Russ just loves making people read.
I just love it. I came to it, I went, I love this. And the thought of you discovering this and considering it so much, because it feels very human.
Okay. I'm going to do like 2 columns max, because okay, there's great. 4. To roll, to bend, to crumple, to split, to remove, to open, to spill, to lift, to flood, to support, to hang, to bundle, to arrange, to distribute, to surround, to wrap, to weave, to bond, to dilute, to stretch, and to systematize. That's just the first thing. But what I found fascinating is, like, I saw that in a show and I was thinking how beautiful, how elegant. But I imagine there's all the things you could do to a body.
Yes, exactly.
And again, when I remember this thing that a tutor again had said in painting school, he said, what is a good hang? And he meant, like, what would you consider? Like, what other artists would you like to hang a show with? Like, have your work? And I was thinking, like, what does he mean? Like, hanging out or, like, hanging, like a lynching? Like, I was thinking some people can't afford that space of, like, poetry. So it's like poetry is almost like this privileged space. So thinking if you don't have access to language, then it goes into the body. And again, what had happened in this breakdown, as everything became literal and everything became a reference to the body, like too close, this proximity. So I kind of like this idea of like taking something so beautiful, so abstract and so refined and just putting it back into the flesh. And again, it's this thing of like code switching, like people know who Richard Serra is and using those things as hooks. And you know, it'd be great if I could get to a point where like I'm not using those things and kind of the language of the work is exists in its own right, but we're always referring to history. There's always a dialectic with history and what we're exposed to. So yeah, that kind of relationship.
And also I think it's authentic anyway, because it's you were touched by that work, therefore it informs what you want to, you know, make as well. So I think it's all just an ongoing, it's what we were talking about before, that continuation, that thread, like the blood, you know, continuation. And that's the same with art history. And even if you look at like printmaking in your work, you know, we haven't really spoken about that, but like, you know, silk screening and the way you print directly onto the canvas, like that's a whole other language. And if you think of like pop art and the way you've used like imagery from like porn magazines or, you know, or soft porn or what have you, you know, like there's all these different languages and different visual connections that I think are just from your, you know, interest in the world. So that's totally valid, isn't it?
That's, I mean, every artist has to, you know, pinch art history. You know, maybe not steal, but maybe just have a little pinch of art history.
Or reference. Yeah. Cite it.
Cite it.
Yeah.
After you've looked at it.
Yeah. But the thing is, I can't remember like these canonic names a lot of the time. So I have this like little note thing in my phone and I have to write all the people that I like artists. Mm. But I remember everything a good friend has said, and I always say, like, you know, oh, so-and-so, my sister said that, like, as my sister said, blah, blah, blah. And I remember, and I'll, to an extreme, cite them. Mm. And I hate it when people, like, would come up with something, and I know where they got it from, and, like, they won't cite their friend or something like that. Right. But I think it's okay to not cite the canon. So, that's my position on it. Like, so again, the emo takes precedence.
Awesome.
I love that. Well, we ask every guest that comes on, Mandy, two of the same questions. The first one is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, shit. I didn't think about this beforehand.
Do you? I know you're a self-confessed hoarder of stuff. Yeah, you're a self-confessed hoarder of stuff. But do you collect art? Do you ever trade with art friends or like along the way? Or
No. I think I wrote this down, actually.
Okay.
In my very important art list that I forget.
It's quite an apt question.
Yeah, because I listened to a good 3 hours of your talks before.
Oh.
And I loved the Kenny Schachter one, man. It was so good. Yeah. He took my two good colours that's going to come up next.
Okay. That's funny.
One sec.
He's such a kind of controversial figure in many ways.
He loves
and I think
Paul
the kind of
purest, yes.
The purest kind of like primary art market often like vilify him and, you know, but I think he's a really important voice actually and a really
he's
fascinating
a good mouse,
one.
Isn't he?
And he's actually a really, I think he's a good person. Like I've hung out with him a few times and he's just genuine. He's just who he is.
Yeah,
and
he
he's
loves
eccentric
art.
And he's passionate and he thinks about things, you know, and he's also not afraid of the new either, you know. He's way more unafraid than I am, like,
yeah, but I'd be really scared if he comes for me. I mean, there was a bit awkward at one point in the talk, which I loved. But I loved it. You backed it for yourself. It was good. I got it. I just forgot the name of the artist. So it's an outsider artist and it's a really beautiful hypnotizing piece. I don't think many people know it. It's by August Natterer. And I think he suffered schizophrenia. And it's just this very, like, humble pencil drawing of, like, two eyes that look like they're missing. And it's so beautiful. I even, like, reproduced it on one of my paintings once. So it's called My Eyes in the Time of Apparition by August Natterer.
Where did you see it? Have you seen it in the flesh?
I saw it in a book that I have. But I remember seeing it as a kid and thinking, like, I'm like really fascinated by outside art because there's something about it not being made for an audience or it being made for a personal audience. Again, that interiority that I really kind of like value.
God, I have never seen that work before and it is extraordinary.
Are you seeing it?
My Eyes in Time of Apparition. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, amazing.
1913. Wow.
Yeah.
And that's so interesting thinking about your work.
Yeah, God. I think it's beautiful.
I share your passion for outsider artists as well, like not making work for a commercial sake or for an audience, but just compulsively making it. And there's something that really reveals more about the human condition.
Yeah, there's an urgency and a frailty to it. Like it's often done on paper, you know, it's like beautiful stuff.
We've interviewed an amazing outsider gallerist called Jennifer Gilbert from Jennifer Lauren Gallery. She's actually going to be on the Series 9 of Talk Art, talking about Shinichi Sawada, who's a Japanese outsider artist. He's extraordinary. Yeah. You should listen to her because I think you'd really like her program.
Yeah,
she's wonderful. Yeah. The other question we ask every guest, which I'm excited to hear your answer, is what is your favorite color?
Yeah, so it's exactly the same as Kenny Schachter's one. Like, there's two. So there's this brown that I really like, which is like iodine brown, and you can't get it in paint. It has this transparency that I really like, and obviously this link to surgery. So in a lot of my work, there's this wash of like diluted poo brown. So that ages things. And I remember like one of the rosters of the galleries, an artist show hadn't sold because it had this brown in it, like pervasively through the show. And I just thought like that's such a nice kind of spanner in the works, and it kind of gives age to, and latex goes that color, so if you embed things in latex it has that kind of browniness. And on the flip side of that, I like reverse stuff, so like I'll do my blue work and the red work. So blue, obviously, that's everyone looks good in blue. In the right blue shirt, everyone looks hotter, and it's like this it's a kind of like cerulean kind of it's described really perfectly in The Devil Wears Prada when she tells the intern off this perfect the right cerulean blue. It's like slash eye blue, basically.
Amazing. That was another thing I was thinking a lot about when I thought about your work, was the eye, you know, that kind of like in Turkey if you go to like Istanbul, they have that kind of blue eye. Like, it's not an all-seeing eye. I think it's more
it's
of
like the evil
eye,
wards off the evil spirits.
For some reason, I was thinking a bit about that, about this idea of your work somehow protecting people.
Oh my God! I literally did a painting of the evil eye, like when I was ill. Yeah.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and it's about protecting. So one of the people I work with, she has these perfect coloured eyes that reminded me of it. I was like, okay, that's Tamara's eye, and it's going to protect me.
Love that.
I'm very literal.
See the work that you wanted to do, the art heist. That's two eyes, isn't it?
Yes.
Natura. I hadn't even thought of that, but that.
Yes.
Yeah, that's good.
I was going to actually wear my evil eyes today, but I don't need them from you guys, so I left them there in the back. Okay. But they're really beautiful. They're tiny little orbs, so no one can see them. They're not like statement pieces.
Cool.
Mandy, you're amazing.
You guys are amazing.
This chat.
This has been so fun.
Yeah.
And brilliant. And
thank you for being so
engaging.
Open, and you're just extraordinary. And I'm so grateful to have sort of met you properly, because I know we've met briefly in the past, but in those weird social circumstances, no one really gets to chat and I can't hear it.
Thank you so much, guys.
Just have dinner with you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Like,
just chill.
This was proper fun for me, and thank you for making me feel so comfortable.
For everybody listening, there are some amazing shows coming up, including the UTA Space solo exhibition, which Mandy's doing in Los Angeles. When is that? Is that later this year?
I think so. I don't know when exactly.
Yeah, well, that's coming up anyway. And then we've got the Lee Bull show, which is on right now. And then you've also got your extraordinarily exciting solo show, your first one in South Korea, in Seoul, again with Layman Maupin. And then later in the year, you're doing stuff with Tadeusz Ropak again, and you've just got lots on, so good times.
Yes.
And you can visit our Instagram, at TalkArt, and see images of all the artworks we've discussed today. And I'll definitely be posting your art heist, because I think that's going to be a real discovery for people. And what's your Instagram? Are you just at Mandy?
Elsewhere. Yeah, it's just my name. Yeah.
Perfect.
Amazing.
Thank you so much, wonderful people. Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
I can't wait to listen to your Paul McCarthy.
Well, I think you're going to get a lot from
that. Oh, my God, yeah.
One of his favourite colours is brown.
Ooh.
And he actually, we had a joke at the end of the episode, which was like, we asked him, what is art? Because he was like, these questions are terrible. Like, it's like saying, what is art? Yeah. So, Mandy, what is art?
What is art, Mandy?
This is not part of the questions, is it? I'm not obliged to answer.
You don't have to answer. But if you can, if you've got a response, is art?
I think it's just much easier to talk about that floating thing that was in the wave pool that you talked about. Yeah, the floater.
Yeah. The little Maltese
that's
poo that I knew
yet. Yes. That's philosophy in a nutshell.
Thanks for listening. On that note, we'll be back very soon.
Okay. Stick around, Matt.
Okay, I will. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.